Hello, and thank you for joining our podcast, Relentless Pursuit, with the Shantz Mantione Group. I'm Andrew Shantz. I'm here with my partner, Tom Mantione from UBS Private Wealth Management, and we are very excited to welcome back Paul Donovan, Chief Economist, UBS Global Wealth Management, for a conversation on the state of the global economy, talk some central banks, and see where the world is heading. Paul, thank you so much for joining us again.
Happy to be back.
First, we always seem to have this conversation in the spring, which is a lot of fun because we always get to ask, what's going on with the sheep on your farm this year?
So the sheep this year are being particularly unruly and keep breaking down the fence, which means I can quite often wake up first thing in the morning to the sound of sheep immediately outside my window where they're not supposed to be. But otherwise, all is good.
That's a little bit like the U.S. immigration problem.
These are legal migrants, so they're accepted.
Understood. Thank you for that.
Well, we may have to chat about that a little bit as well. I know we had an interesting report on the effects of immigration on the U.S. economy, but we'll come back to that one. So kind of getting right into it, there was a lot of changes in central banks last week. Swiss National Bank lowering, Bank of Japan rising, Fed just being the Fed. It seems like turbulence, seems like a lot of things are going on. How do you interpret all of that stuff?
All right, so let's start with the basics. Cutting rates is not necessarily easing policy. And that's important because a lot of the rate cuts we're going to get this year are not actually going to be an easing of monetary policy. Because what I think is going to be happening is central banks are going to follow inflation down. So inflation comes down, interest rates come down. The real inflation-adjusted interest rate, which is what economists get really excited about, that doesn't change. So that gives us quite a big hint as to why the Swiss National Bank cut rates, because Switzerland has had substantially lower inflation. It did have a small pickup, but nothing like what we saw in Europe or in the US. And it's come down, and it's been well below 2% for some time. So essentially, the Swiss National Bank is simply accepting inflation is lower. We need to be lowering rates to maintain a stable real rate. Now, I would say the move was probably a shock inside Switzerland. Less of a shock, still a surprise, but not a oh my goodness, what are they doing outside of Switzerland? And that's because I think inside Switzerland there was an expectation that they'd follow the ECB. Now, the problem with that is that the ECB is absolutely useless at taking any kind of decision whatsoever. The SNB, I think quite rightly, said, you know, we're not going to hang around for these guys. Lagarde will take forever. Let's just go ahead and do it. Bank of Japan was normalizing, and the great negative rate experiment. I mean, the thing about negative rates is, you know, everyone says, oh, it's a stimulus. Well, not really. Negative rates are a tax on the financial system. That's how it actually manifests economically. And I think the Bank of Japan has just decided, you know what, zero's not a bad idea. So they're normalizing there. Now, with the Fed, and indeed with the Bank of England, which is, of course, the most important central bank in the world, what we have there is, I think, central banks clearly signaling that they are intending to cut, that they're not going to wait for inflation to hit the magic 2% number. And that's quite right, because monetary policy operates with a lag. So if you're cutting rates now, that really affects the economy in 12, 18 months' time. So they're signaling, I think, second quarter rate cuts. With the Fed, this came mainly through the ramblings of Fed Chair Powell. At the press conference, always a little tricky to interpret, but you know, it seems to be the direction of travel for Fed members. With the Bank of England, it came through with the fact that two dissenters who'd been voting for higher rates stopped voting for higher rates and started saying, you know what, maybe we were wrong. And they voted for unchanged, but that's a step towards getting the cut coming through. What I think has happened with the markets is the markets have increased the certainty of three or four rate cuts this year from each of the major central banks. So it's not that we're radically changing the view or necessarily changing the timing or expectations, but markets have got greater certainty.
Thank you for that explanation. You make it much less sensational than they make it in the media in terms of what these moves are designed to do.
Are you possibly suggesting that the financial media sensationalizes in order to get clicks? Family. Yeah, I don't need to sensationalize. So, you know, I'm not here to be dramatic. I'm here to be right. I don't think it is that sensational. No, this is an evolutionary process. Frankly, the most sensational thing was that the Bank of England member Mann changed her view, because Mann hasn't changed her view in 30 years that I can see. So, I mean, that was about as sensational as it got. This is just an evolution as economies evolve, as inflation evolves. I don't think it's actually particularly shocking, frankly.
You know, as we talk about central banks changing direction, I hesitate to ask this question this way, but I'm going to try it. Back
in
2011, I'm going to get in trouble. Back in 2011, Trichet raised rates early and then caused a hiccup for the ECB, which fostered a ton more QE. One of my concerns, and I'm not that smart, so it doesn't really matter what I think, but I worry that we get into a position where the US Fed lowers interest rates too quickly because they've just walked themselves into this path, and all of a sudden inflation starts to climb, and we're in that kind of position where the opposite position, if you will, that Trichet was in 2011. Is there a risk to that?
So there's always a risk of policy error. And I think in the case of the Fed, there are two potential reasons for that. The first is Powell, not a qualified economist. I believe he's a qualified lawyer. But there's a genuine issue here, because the Fed has become this monoculture. You know, at least at the Bank of England, there's a decent fight going on every meeting. But at the Fed, we just don't get dissent anymore. And I think that's a shame, because dissent tends to make the better decisions. So that's the first issue. The second issue, which we've talked about in the past, is the quality of data really has declined. And so it's not that you're flying blind, but you're flying through a fairly thick fog. Mm-hmm. And you know, you can sort of see the vague outlines of what the economy is doing. We don't have the precision. So both of these things do give grounds for concern. Mm-hmm. Having said that, there are a lot of indicators in the detail of inflation that say to me, we're really not likely to see a big pickup in inflation pressures. In fact, inflation is likely to continue to come down. So economists often get accused of sort of taking the inflation number and then subtracting all the bits we don't like to get a lower number. That's not true. We do subtract a lot of the time, but that's because we want to try and focus in on certain forces. So I'm not denying, you know, the headline inflation number is what you're supposed to look at. Right. But actually, by taking away some of the noise, you can get a clearer idea of the trend. And that's what we're doing. That's what the many economists at the Fed are doing. Mm-hmm. So let's have a look at some of these things. So the first point is a purely technical one. The way that owner's equivalent rent is calculated, this fictional housing number that you guys are so addicted to, and which makes up a quarter of the CPI calculation. I mean, it constantly astounds me. One quarter of the CPI in the United States is a fairy tale. It's a complete made-up number. I will get off my soapbox and stop ranting on that. But
by the way, one that doesn't necessarily impact our clients much at all.
Well, the only way it impacts your clients, actually, is because nobody actually pays this price. So it's an entirely made-up number. No one pays the price. However, tax brackets go up in line with CPI automatically every year, because that's one of Nixon's legacies, that he index-linked tax brackets. And so if you get a high owner's equivalent rent, it means the tax bracket will go up by more, because the CPI will go up by more. So there is there's sort of a very, very vague link there. However, the technical way that OER is calculated means that almost certainly in March, if not in April, we're going to get a big drop in the CPI. So the number's going to come down, because basically, you know, the OER is going to start converging a bit more with the reality of home ownership. Alongside that, though, not just in the States, but also here in the UK and in the Euro area, when you look at market-based prices, they are coming down in line or in many cases more quickly than headline CPI. So what does that tell me? Well, that tells me that the headline CPI is being propped up by prices that are not driven by supply and demand. So that may be tax rates, owner's equivalent rent, controlled prices, so pharmaceutical prices are controlled in quite a number of countries, healthcare, education, doesn't matter what it is, non-market forces. Now, why is that important? because if we were going to see persistent price stickiness from profiteering, if we were going to see wage-driven inflation, that would show up first and foremost in the market prices. And there we're not seeing it. So that again gives me quite a lot of confidence that we're going to be continuing to see this moderation of inflation over the course of the year. Now, you know, energy card price is always a wild card, but I'm fairly confident with sort of a 2 to 2.5% inflation range for most of the major economies. The UK will probably go below 2% in the second quarter. Again, that's largely technical and administered prices. Europe is already fairly close. And like I keep saying, large parts of the United States are already below 2% inflation.
I do have to come back to the T word, transitory. And there was a lot of discussion about how inflation was transitory, and then it was, I guess the definition of, depends what your definition of is, right? Depends what your definition of transitory is. And certainly we as a firm thought that things were transitory. Do you feel like that was the right description at the time? Has too much time passed? If we could have changed the thought process there, could we have assumed that it was going to take longer to get where we're at?
So the thing is, the inflation was transitory. So the inflation of 2021 lasted about 18 months and then disappeared. And it went back to normal within 18 months. So the transitory inflation story was all about the fact that everyone was coming out of the pandemic with, you know, their pockets stuffed with cash, you know, banknotes piled up under the mattress, and they went to spend the money. And so you've got this absolutely extraordinary surge in demand. In the US, you saw the strongest surge in demand for consumer durable goods, so furniture, electronics, that kind of stuff. Strongest demand that we've seen since President Truman ended wartime rationing. I mean, it was absolutely extraordinary, and it overwhelmed supply. And so economists say, well, look, okay, demand has surged, but this can't last. At some point, you've spent the savings. At some point, you're going to stop buying the televisions and the furniture and the new washing machines because, you know, once you've got a washing machine, that's it. You buy it once, you don't buy it 2-3 times. And then you're going to start seeing spending on the more important things in life, like Taylor Swift concert tickets. I know you're a massive Swiftie, Andrew. So you're getting that shift in terms of consumer spending. And that is exactly what happened. And as that happened, durable goods price inflation came crashing down. So that whole transitory narrative was actually entirely correct. The problem, from a perception point of view, is Russia invaded Ukraine. And so at the moment that economists are declaring victory and central banks are patting themselves on the back, you then get a war and an energy shock, which is obviously completely different to a supply-demand imbalance. And that then perpetuates the higher inflation story. And that then eventually feeds through into a profit-led inflation, which was partly because of the war and some other factors. So the thing is, the transitory inflation was transitory. Now, this is actually very important because a lot of central banks at the moment are doing reviews of their economic models. And the ECB is just on one of these. And the conclusion of this is actually, you know what? It wouldn't have made much of a difference if we'd have raised rates earlier. We'd have still gone through that transitory inflation. And the transitory inflation would still have ended as it did, because actually monetary policy had virtually nothing to do with either the huge surge in demand or the normalization of demand that came through. It was just this really weird situation born out of the aftermath of the pandemic.
So you stole one part of my next question as you were talking, and the answer is not, there is no answer, right? But would this have all happened had the Fed not raised rates?
So I think that what we have to remember is, of course, we came out of the pandemic with emergency interest rate levels.
Yeah.
So I'm not saying the Fed should not have raised rates. Of course it should have raised rates. You don't keep rates at an emergency level when there is no emergency. You normalize. Mm-hmm. Should the Fed have been as aggressive as they have been? No, I think, frankly, Powell has made a series of mistakes. And he's taken it too far, because the transitory inflation was going to end anyway. Raising interest rates had no bearing on the events going on in Ukraine, clearly. You can make a case, I think, that raising interest rates might have contributed somewhat to the squeezing of profit margins, the reversal of profit-led inflation, which is essentially retailers exploiting consumers and raising prices. Possibly interest rates have had a small impact there. But actually, you know, this cycle, the inflation patterns have been quasi-independent, let's put it that way, quasi-independent of central bank policy. Both sides of the Atlantic. This is not a unique to the US phenomenon. It's also the case over in the UK and in Europe.
You talked a little bit there about perception. We'll veer into politics just for a second and ask who you think is going to win the election. No, nothing like that. So in terms of who are you voting for? He doesn't have to vote. He doesn't have to worry. He doesn't have to make the worst choice ever. So in terms of the U.S. economy, after all this has happened, feels like we're doing well. But President Biden gets no credit for things feeling like we're doing well. And we had a conversation with John Savercool from our Office of Public Policy yesterday, kind of on this point, where I've seen some polling that says when they ask Americans, how are you doing financially? They say, we're doing great. And then they say, how is your neighbors doing? Oh, they're doing terrible. And everybody says the same thing. So I'm curious to your thoughts as to why, if you do feel like we're doing well as an economy, why that is the administration not getting anything out of that at the moment?
Well, I mean, so the economy is, I mean, it's quite remarkable. Look at the drop in inflation over the last couple of years. Look at the increase in unemployment. There isn't an increase in unemployment, and yet inflation has just plummeted in the US. And again, this isn't unique to the United States. This is what's happened in Europe. This is what's happened in the UK. And governments are not necessarily getting the credit. To be fair, the decline in inflation has got very little to do with government policy either, because I suppose arguably the military situation in Ukraine, certain policies affected energy prices, maybe. There has been some political pressure on profit-led inflation, which has had some effect. But you know, a lot of this was actually going to happen anyway, regardless of policy. Nevertheless, the issue that we have here is the perception problem. And the example I always use is the Snickers bar, so much so that I believe Snickers are getting quite upset about the fact that we use Snickers as the example. And it's their fault for having the highest selling chocolate bar in the United States. So the point here is essentially around two issues. People remember the price of something they buy frequently, and they don't remember the price of something that they buy once every 2 or 3 years. How many people listening to this can remember what was the price you paid for the last television you bought? I think no one can remember, because you know, it's in the dim and distant past. And even if you do remember the last television, what about the one before that? Was it higher or lower? Well, I can tell you, the price was almost certainly higher, but you won't remember that. But if the price of your Snickers bar in the vending machine goes up, then you are going to remember that, because it's a frequent purchase, and every time you go and buy, you're reminded of this increase in price. And so you have this perception that, oh, prices are rising all over the place. My favorite example of this is Italy in 2002. So in 2002, you may recall, the euro area introduced the euro notes and coins. So in Italy, they introduced euro notes and coins. And the price of an espresso coffee went from 1,000 lira to 1 euro. Well, that sounds perfectly reasonable. There was 1,000 lira coin. There's a 1 euro coin, you're handing over a single coin for your espresso coffee. The problem with this is 1,000 lira is not the same as 1 euro. 1,000 lira is 0.52 euros. So you'd almost doubled the price of espresso overnight. Now, your average Milanese drinks 6 espresso a day, which is a whole different problem for a different topic. So 6 times a day, you're being reminded the price of this has just gone up 100%, give or take. And so you get this perception that everything's collapsing, inflation's out of control, et cetera, et cetera. And that's what we've got at the moment with the frequency purchase, high frequency purchases, creating the perception thing.
To your point about the TV, right? $100 decline in a television, how many cartons of a dozen eggs does that buy?
Well, exactly. In the CPI weighting, televisions are far more important than candy bars. Again, it's your perception that you're dealing with. And then there's a second issue, which is people, particularly with high frequency purchases, remember the historic price level. And although inflation is about the change in price, people still feel cheated if the price level is above the one that they think is fair. Now, normally, people will remember a price level for about 18 months. So remember, well, the Snickers bar used to cost me a dollar, and now it costs $2, which is perfectly plausible because in vending machines, you tend to round up to the nearest dollar. In that situation, you're going to have 18 months of thinking the Snickers bar is really supposed to cost me $1. I'm paying an outrageously high price. And then eventually, you'll mentally reset and the new price will become your mental benchmark. But as I said, that takes 18 months. Now, veering into the election territory, this is where I think things get potentially interesting. I read an article recently where I said, you know, I believe that the election could be won or lost in the aisles of Walmart. But what we're now starting to see, for example, is food price inflation has come down a lot. Some food price levels are falling. Certain products, the price is actually coming down. Mm-hmm. And you remember, about a year ago, eggs in the United States are trading at the same price as crack cocaine.
Yeah.
Now they've come back down to more reasonable levels. So you've now got negative price inflation. And that sort of thing changes perception. And also, I think you've seen fewer price increases over the last 12 months. So that 18-month reset may actually now start to be happening. So as we approach November, I think some of the high-frequency inflation could start to abate as a problem.
Is that also, you've written often about profit-led inflation, is that part of that as well in the food aisles, bringing it down?
It is, because profit-led inflation is something which tends to take place at the retail level, and food is one of the areas which is very vulnerable to profit-led inflation. Now, This isn't even across all economies. So when we look at food price inflation, for example, Germany's had a real problem, UK's had quite a big problem, with this, Spain has had quite a big problem. On the other hand, Switzerland, no problem at all. And ironically, I think it's because there's a duopoly in Switzerland. There's basically only two places you can go and buy food. As a result, neither of the supermarkets dare raise prices too much because they're concerned about political interference. But where you've got a more oligopolistic structure, like Germany or the UK, there you have seen profit-led inflation really push up food prices. So since 2020, food prices in these countries are 30% plus. Now, if we look at the States, that from memory is about 25, 26% the start of 2020. So you're not quite as bad as the oligopolies, but there has undoubtedly been profit-led inflation. Retailers' profits as a share of GDP have gone from roughly 14% to 21% in the space of 2 years. If your profit-GDP ratio is going up from 14% to 21%, that's telling you something about what's driving the inflation. But now consumers are rebelling. Walmart's chief exec, last two quarterly results, has been saying, if we raise prices, customers don't reduce demand, they stop demanding. He's sounding very upset by it. But this is economics 101. Consumers suddenly feel that price increase isn't fair, they won't pay it. And that rebellion is coming through in things like the Beige Book, the Fed's gossip magazine. It's coming through in individual sentiment surveys and comments. So we're clearly seeing consumer rebellion coming through.
There's one more point. Since we're in the grocery store as we're talking, we found out that not only do you take care of sheep and we know that you're a boxer, you and I actually have something in common, as I read in your blog, that as teenagers, we both worked in supermarkets.
Absolutely.
And now we both work in them again.
Yep.
Right? As unpaid checkout operators, as you like to say, and checking out our own groceries. And although I don't like it when they make you check them out on your own and then check your work as you leave and look at the receipt. I think you can do one or the other. Is that a significant impact on the cost of food, or is that just going in the pocket of the retailers? And also, is that something that gets picked up? Is it a significant impact in GDP, or is it just something that's annoying me?
It is something which is part of a wider trend. So a lot of the conversations I have with clients at the moment, the inflation worry has pivoted to wages. But the thing is, wages are not really the driver of inflation. It's wage costs. And wage costs depend on three things. How much do you pay your workers? How many workers do you have? And how hard do those workers work? So if you're paying more money but to fewer workers who are doing more, then your wage bill overall is not necessarily going to be a big problem. And so that's a very, very critical thing. So if we look at the supermarkets, supermarkets are a good example. There's near the UBS office at Liverpool Street, we have M&S Simply Food, which is sort of a high-end supermarket for city workers. So your economist going in there to buy dinner, can of baked beans, loaf of bread, bottle of wine, you know, the basics, all major food groups represented. I check out myself. There are 20 checkouts there. Not one of them is manned. There's not a single person there. So the store employs about four people. There's a security guard, there's three people putting stuff out on shelves. Not 24 people. So that cost for the firm has come down. And that is absolutely fantastic. You don't even get somebody coming along to check you're old enough to buy the bottle of wine, because there's a little camera on top of the checkout which takes one look at me and says, yes, he's clearly old enough, which frankly is offensive. But you're getting that automatic process. Now, the point about this is you are allowing the supermarket to pay higher wages to the remaining staff, but there are fewer staff, and they're doing more work. More customers are running up things. So, because I'm working as an unpaid checkout operator. So that can be passed on in lower food prices. It can help support profit margins. It's both of those things happening at the same time. The problem from the macroeconomic perspective is that if I'm working unpaid for M&S Simply Food as a checkout operator, that does not count towards GDP. My economic activity does not count towards GDP. And so as we automate parts of the economy, as we get people to do things for themselves, because it's not just supermarkets, you know, this is online retail. You know, if I buy online anything online, nobody is sitting there at a cash register ringing things up. It's all automated. I'm paying for it. I'm essentially, you know, choosing the goods myself. I'm paying myself. Yes, they're then sending the goods to me. But again, we're reducing the contributions to GDP. Now, at the end of the day, I've still got my baked beans on toast and my bottle of wine. My standard of living is not really suffering for the fact that I've had to spend 2 minutes scanning three items through a checkout. I'm still getting the same standard of living, but GDP is lower than it would otherwise be.
So I love that you use the word GDP, because it took us almost 30 minutes to get there. And as an economist, usually that's one of the first things we talk about. So let's talk about U.S. GDP for a second. We've had higher than expected GDP for a while now, I would think. You mentioned Taylor Swift. Maybe she and Beyonce had something to do with that last year. I know it's simple for us to find out the forecast that you and your team have. What concerns you about the C plus I plus G plus X model in the U.S.? If there's something that you're on the horizon looking at that could derail the U.S. economy, almost historic rise here, what would that be?
So I think the thing is that at the moment, the U.S. economy, it's not G, because G is a negative. Government spending, yes, governments are still spending. They're spending less than they were last year.
For sure.
So that's a drag on growth. Global trade is probably going to be falling as a share of global GDP this year. So you know, the global trade pattern is not really going to be contributing. Investment, not really a big contribution at the moment. I mean, investment's got quite a low weighting, not really a big contribution to U.S. economic activity. And that, again, partly that may be efficiency. But you're thinking, well, actually, we've got people working flexibly. We don't need so much office space. Well, you know, guess what? Office space, office equipment, that's all investment.
Yeah.
Not taking place so much. Still get the same output, but you don't have the same investment. So that means the consumer. Now, the good news here, of course, is that the mantra that every economist learns, you know, straight after they draw their first supply and demand curve is never, ever, ever go short the hedonism of the U.S. consumer. So there is this solid base for consumer spending, which over the last 3 years has been funded out of savings, primarily, and a bit of credit, because real income growth was quite negative. But what's now happened is finally real income growth has normalized. So you don't have to keep cutting the savings rate, although I bet some of you will. You're actually relying on the rise in consumer spending, in real income to fuel the consumer spending. Now, what could go wrong with that? I mean, yes, an inflation shock. I don't think we get that, as we've discussed. The thing which concerns me, really, it would be an unexpected pick up in unemployment, or more accurately, in the fear of unemployment. Because if you're worried that you may not have a job in 6 months' time, then you're going to do what economists call precautionary saving, which is incentive. Take out an insurance policy, you save a bit more money because you know what, things aren't looking so good. And so if we were to see fear of unemployment, particularly for middle-income consumers, because they're the ones that really, they're the swing voters in the economy, is the middle-income consumer. If you lose the job security of that group, that's a problem. So far, we have had, obviously, some quite high-profile companies announcing job losses. The point about this, though, is that these job losses have tended to be very concentrated by sector and by geography. So what that means is that, you know, most people do not know somebody who has lost their job. So not only do you feel fairly safe in your own job, no one in your social circle, if you're a middle-income consumer, has lost their job in most cases. And so that reassures you, and the spending keeps going. So the fear, I think, for me is very much around the labor market. That's where we're focusing attention. Now, we have to be careful here. Unemployment is going to tick up. If it ticks up because companies are hiring less and that graduate who's just got their nice shiny new degree can't find a job, I'm very sorry for the graduate, but economically, that's not so much of a problem.
Okay. Yeah.
If unemployment picks up because companies are firing, that's when the fear level starts, and that's when, you know, we start to look with some nervousness at the consumer level. But it's basically, it's all down to the consumer, and at the moment, you guys are indulging in hedonistic excess, and it's all great.
We're good at that.
I think mostly Andrew.
Years of practice.
Years of practice. So what you said is extremely interesting to me, and I want to take this and kind of expand it on the diagonal. And if we think about, I guess, what some people call the fourth industrial revolution, right? We talk about robots, we talk about AI, which is, we're not going to ask you to talk about asset bubbles and inflation and asset prices and where things are and why. But clearly there's a sense that artificial intelligence is going to change the world. And when we look at a world where this digital revolution building on electronics and information that's used to automate things, that seems to be a direct threat to those middle people that you're talking about, maybe. So how do you think, from a much broader sense, what's the trajectory on that? I mean, is AI going to cause a lot of people to lose their jobs? Maybe not this year, but in 3 years, 5 years, 10 years, does that restructure how the workforce looks, much as the pandemic restructured the fact that I'm in an office and Nicole's in an office and there's several people who are working from remote spots? You know, how does that start to pan out? What's the impact on the US economy going forward from that kind of stuff?
So, I mean, I genuinely believe social media is a more disruptive force than AI, because I think that that has far more implications in terms of politics and society and income streams and so on. But AI is going to make changes. I mean, this is genuine. It's not a bored ape NFT. This is a proper piece of technology. As with any other piece of technology, this is disruptive. People are going to lose their jobs, but it's also going to create jobs. Mm-hmm. This is the key point. AI is no different from the steam engine in that regard. You will see AI destroying a certain amount of jobs. Now, Chris Bessarides, the Nobel laureate, has a very good way of sort of explaining this. He says, right, sit down, think of your job. Your job is a series of tasks. If more than half the tasks that you do can be automated away, change your job, because that job's not going to exist. But if fewer than half your tasks can be automated, your job will change, because you'll now start using AI as a tool. But you're not going to lose the job. You know, the job still exists. It's just going to be different in the future. Mm-hmm. And you've got to be flexible enough to adapt to that. If you're saying, no, this is how I've always done it, and I'm going to carry on doing it that way, then you need to be considering retirement. If we think about the jobs that are going to be created, so there will be jobs that are lost. You know, if more than 50% of the tasks can be automated away, the job goes. But there will be new jobs created. And these come in three different categories. So the first is just directly. Somebody's got to ask the computer the questions. Somebody's got to build the computer on which AI runs. So those are going to create jobs directly related to the infrastructure and the operation of AI. And we're seeing that already. Secondly, you only use a new technology because it improves efficiency. If it doesn't make things more efficient, you don't use the new technology. Why bother? What that means is, by introducing a technology like AI, you will lower barriers to entry. And I'll use social media as the parallel. 20 years ago, there were a relatively limited number of people who could make a living doing audiovisual entertainment. So television stars, film stars. There's a limited number because it's extremely expensive to make a film or television series. But then along comes the smartphone and social media, and the barriers to entry simply collapse. And now you have got hundreds of thousands of people making livings, earning a decent income as social media influencers, which is just audiovisual entertainment, different format, but you've lowered the barrier to entry. And by doing that, you've created a whole series of jobs. So that's the second area. And then the third area, so back in 1930, Lord Keynes, the famous British economist, wrote a book. And in this book, he predicted that by 2030, we would all be working 15-hour weeks because of technological change. Now, I don't know about you, but economists at UBS are not working 15-hour weeks. 15-hour days, if we're lucky, but not 15-hour weeks. But Keynes was actually right. Because what has happened over the last 100 years is the amount of time spent doing unpaid chores has collapsed. To do a family's washing in 1930 was a two-day process. And now it's 30 seconds. You toss it in the machine, toss in a detergent capsule, and off you go. You've seen, actually, this decline in the amount of time spent doing unpaid chores. And it actually works out to roughly the equivalent of cutting the work week to 15 hours a week. Why does that matter? Because all of a sudden you've got additional leisure. And we're back to Taylor Swift. Somebody's going to be providing the leisure industry, the leisure content. So the explosion, I mean, think about 100 years ago, leisure wasn't really a thing. I mean, yes, you know, there was the occasional music hall, and if you were high income, sort of gilded age type stuff, then yes, plenty of leisure. But the majority of the population did not have a great deal of leisure. I mean, my grandmother, when she was young in the East End of London, the summer holiday was going to work on a farm in Kent because it was a different location and you got to stay in the countryside, but you still had to work a 12-hour day and that was your summer holiday. Now we've got this leisure concept. And of course, that created an absolute boom in jobs. So we're going to create new jobs directly by lowering barriers and by increasing leisure time, I think. The challenge, and this is where it gets tricky, is that lawyer's clerk who's been automated out of existence, are they going to become a TikTok media sensation? Probably not. Well, not least because you guys seem to be banning the thing, but you're not going to get that shit coming through. So that then creates a challenge because it's what we call in economics frictional unemployment. In the end, it all comes out okay. But in the end, it's sort of 15 years into the future. Mm-hmm. And if you don't have flexibility, that's a mental state. That's not how easy is it to hire and fire. Do you have people who are prepared to adapt, prepared to go back to the drawing board? Are you going to take a 50-something economist and say, right, you need to completely retrain and start being an assistant or a hotel operator or whatever it's going to be? That then becomes very difficult. And so that's what we've got to focus on, because if you don't have the flexibility, you will have simultaneously a shortage of workers and excess unemployment.
Yeah. Interesting. I appreciate you taking the time to point out the lowered barrier to entry for anybody, talented or not, producing audiovisual content, as we've demonstrated here today.
That's great.
Paul, always a pleasure. We could talk for hours, as we have in the past. I and our listeners, our clients who like to listen to your comments and the fun that we have, really, really appreciate this. I wish you all the best in getting your teenager sheep in line and to have them stop knocking down your fences. As always, we'd love to invite you back sometime if you'd be up for it.
Absolutely. No, thanks very much, and thanks for a really enjoyable session.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.